first point is kind of the structure and format of the class is quite a bit different from any other classes you may have had from me, in that I want to do it around the table and have a seminar discussion type approach, and even less lecture than you're already used to from me. I know I don't do a lot of lecturing anyway, but the responsibility for making sound will be equally distributed amongst all of us, and I'll be happy to answer questions and participate, but I don't plan to do a lot of straight lecturing. I'll bring demonstrations, I'll bring computer software, I'll bring charts and graphs, I'll do all I can, but I think this class has really worked well in this other format. So I hope that works for you. Another comment I'd like to make is about the textbook. I showed it briefly on the Elmo a few minutes ago. This is the second edition of Thornton and Rex. I found out recently that the third edition is out, but I don't have it yet. So that means you can still buy fairly cheaply the second edition, and it's just fine. It works great. We've used it for the past few years and quite like it. It is a step above the last few chapters in your Physics for Scientists and Engineers book. If that's Surway or Halliday and Resnick or what we're using lately here is Knight, the last few chapters of that book will go into some of these modern physics topics. But that's just one notch below where we want to hit with the rigor level in this course. And so I picked this book as being a good compromise between being rigorous enough, but not being overwhelming or a junior level or senior level book that might be too much depth. It is a fairly substantial book, though, and it's quite well respected. When the University of Utah found out that we used this book, they were very impressed. All of a sudden, they decided maybe this course would transfer to their modern physics course. So it's a well-respected book, and that means it's not an easy blow-off book. But on the other hand, the book we used to use, which I felt was kind of one notch down and a little bit easier in rigor, didn't explain things as well. And I found, even myself, and I'm supposed to understand and know this stuff, as I was reading through the other book in preparation for class, I'd say, what? What are they talking about? And I didn't think it explained things very well, even though it was at a lesser level than this one. So I like this both for the level of rigor and for the clarity of the explanations and concepts. I hope you like the book, too. It's not quite as conversational as Randy Knight's book, but it's still quite readable, and it covers it at the level I would like to cover it. But because it's that thick, and because it has 16 chapters, and because it could be used in a two-semester physics course, we have to make some compromises on how much of it we're going to do. One option would be to chop out some chapters entirely. I don't favor that option particularly. Now, you might have some influence if you feel strongly about this, and maybe you vote strongly and adamantly to cut out a couple of chapters so that we can spend more time on other chapters. But what I've done in the past and has seemed to work reasonably well for previous years for this course is read the whole book, but not spend equal amounts of time, effort, and homework in each of the chapters. It gives you a chance to get exposed to all of the ideas because you read every chapter, but some of the ones, especially in the middle, we really, reading it is about all we do, more or less. And we do a little bit of class discussion, a little bit of homework, but we try to emphasize, because it's only a one-semester course, I try to spend a pretty hefty amount of time on relativity and quantum mechanics, which are the two things that pop into your mind first when you think of modern physics. That's exactly what you think of, but there are other things too. There's solid state physics, molecular, nuclear, and then there's cosmology, string theory, things like that, that are all welcome and at home and chapters in a book like this. So I like to spend a little extra time on relativity, quantum mechanics, and then some of the fun stuff at the end with cosmology, and some of the really, really modern stuff, 21st century, like string theory and things like that. And that means that what I do for the middle chapters, 8, 9, 10, 11, in there on solid state, molecular, and atomic, is have you become acquainted with the ideas through reading, but not trying to burden you down with a lot of homework in those chapters or an in-depth discussion. You probably will feel gypped a little bit in those chapters, But the alternative might be worse. If we really tried to do them all in depth, it would be too much of a workload, and I'm cognizant that most of you have lots of other things to do, either a full load of classes or teaching full-time or whatever it might be. I don't want to burden you down with this class. I'd like to make the workload as light as possible but still be a significant learning experience. I'm trying to strike the fine balance there. It's not the same workload that I give in the Physics for Scientists and Engineers. It's much less than that. But on the other hand, if you don't do any homework or don't do anything, you don't learn anything either. So I try to find the balance there and expose you to the ideas, emphasize the ones I think they're maybe the most fun, the most interesting, the most important, and hopefully that's a good compromise. At this point, I would like responses to my little speech. Who has first comment? Are you agreeable, or do you wish we'd do something different, or what would you like to do? I see that I'm going to have to bring my multi-sided die. When I go to a class with 20 students in it, I bring my 20-sided die, and I roll that to see who's going to talk next. A class this size only needs a regular 6-sided die, and we'll assign you each a number, and I will roll the die, and whoever's number comes up will speak. But I didn't bring a die today, and so, Jacob.
All right, let me push this.
Question is, the structure, format of the course, how we approach the book, the level of rigor, emphasizing certain things, is that okay with you?
Yeah, it is okay with me. Sounds good.
Would you rather do what I said or just entirely skip those chapters completely and not even read them?
I'd rather do what you said.
Okay. Read them. Teresa, your turn.
That sounds reasonable to me. You know, just to skim through certain things and emphasize others.
Now we plan. Okay, good. We could do all of the chapters in a lower level book that's shorter. The old book we used to use was thinner and not as rigorous, and you could pretty much hit every chapter, but I didn't think it explained things as well, and it wasn't as well respected of a book or course across the state. And so, anyway, that's how I feel. Marty Lynn, you get to talk now. She says she's not going to put the camera on, but she's going to still talk into a microphone. It's hard to hear you. Okay. Miles.
Sounds like a good idea to me. Can't
all right.
Cover it all.
You're a very agreeable group. Deb, how about you?
Okay, well, I'll play the devil's advocate. I'd rather not read them. Just because I read very slowly, and so any reading that I can pop out, I would rather do that. But
read.
I will do whatever the class decides.
Okay. Well, that's good information, and it's almost a relief to not have it be so totally unanimous. Get a little dissent here. I think most people are in agreement. We may go ahead and do that, but maybe we can do some things to help you find the time and emphasize just even sections of the chapter rather than reading the whole chapter. We may be able to do some things like that on some of those middle chapters. Does everybody have the book?
It's coming, supposedly.
Yes, I have it. Okay. I paid $5.45 for mine.
Wow, you beat Marty Lynn. Okay, yours is coming?
Yeah.
It's not here yet? Teresa, is yours here?
Yeah, I have a copy.
All right.
I do, I got.
I have one extra copy, which I like to have on hand and use myself and bring to class or take home or stuff, but I would be willing to loan it out for a day or two until yours come, but I only have one of those, so you might have to work it out between you. All right. To the syllabus. Distant sites, did you receive the facts for the one-page syllabus?
Yes, we have it.
Okay. Let's look at that. And believing that...
Well, I didn't mean to speak for Teresa. I have my copy. Sorry, Teresa.
Oh, Deb, do you and Teresa know each other? Have you had classes before?
No.
I met at a math conference.
Yeah.
That's how I heard about this class from her.
Oh, okay. Well, that's great. So you've kind of been introduced. It'll be nice to be classmates. I believe that since you're big boys and girls and are in college, that you can most likely read. So I don't plan to read the syllabus to you, but I'd like to point out some things and highlight some things. I'm an email person. I just like email better than phones, but if you are a phone person, I can still communicate that way, and I would be happy to try and become a phone person for you. If you need to call me, my phone number's on there. I would welcome calls, but I just find that phones, you get frustrated when they're not in, and I have classes and meetings. So email gets through, and then I can reply when I get back. So email address is on there, and then the class website, well, it's my website, but the first page that comes up will have a link to our specific class, Phys 2710. And in there is a copy of this very syllabus and first two chapters of homework assignments. I hope you're pleasantly surprised by the size of them. There aren't very many problems. I've tried to go through and really be selective and pick the ones that are the most educational, and usually I try not to pick the ones that are the very hardest either. It'd be easy to do that, and you might learn a little bit more, but I'm cognizant of my clientele. A couple of you aren't even physics majors, and so I have to be aware that you have lots of other classes going on, and so I'm really very worried about overloading you. I'm trying to avoid that. So give me feedback. I think the workload is a normal workload rather than the excessive workload in the other class. Normal workload means approximately 2 hours outside of class for every hour in. That's the old, decades-old, centuries-old rule of thumb for college. It's an average. Some classes you get by with a lot less than that. In university physics, it's a lot more than that. But on average, your classes should work out to about 2 hours outside of class for every hour in. And I think I'm in the ballpark with this class. And that would include the reading. And you're going to do a lot of reading, so that doesn't leave a whole lot of time to do homework, and hence the fairly small assignments. Now, I have had students before, in fact, I've even got one now, who believes that the way to learn physics is to do homework problems. And there is a whole lot of truth to that sentiment. And these type of students will do more than is assigned. If you're one of those, you're going to get more than your tuition money's worth out of this class, and you're going to learn a lot of extra stuff. I would encourage you to do more homework problems than are assigned, particularly in view of the fact that I'm consciously not assigning a whole lot. You could profitably do more than I assign. But the ones that actually get turned in and graded are, I think, reasonable. However, I would encourage you to give me feedback. After 3 or 4 weeks, if you find that they are too short and you don't think you got your money's worth and you want more work to learn the stuff, I could accommodate you. On the other hand, you would also give me feedback if even the assignments I've given you are taking you 17 hours apiece. I would worry about that. I hope that's not the case, but let me know. We've talked about the text. Let's take just a minute on the co-requisites or prerequisites. Some of this kind of used to be listed as prerequisite, but we don't really necessarily need you to have had them beforehand. If you're enrolled in Physics 2220 or have had it before, that's the Physics for Scientists and Engineers. Some of you have had it years and years ago. That's fine. Others of you are in it now, and that's fine too. That's all cool. But that is kind of important to either be in it or have had it. It would probably not be a good idea to enroll in this course if you hadn't had that or weren't in it now. I also list a couple of math courses, Calc 3 and differential equations, but it says over to the side that those would just merely be nice. When we first started this class at Snow College, I required those, and a couple of things changed my mind. One is that nobody signed up for the course, and the other is that I decided that it wasn't absolutely necessary, and that the concepts out of those classes that we do need and use, I can bring up and teach you as we go. Now, math major Miles has probably had these, and so he's going to be relatively at home and feel like that's easy stuff for him, and he's seen it before. But others of you, when we get to chapter 6 on the hydrogen atom, the simplest atomic system in the universe, you will be surprised at how much math is involved. But I'll bring you along and I'll teach you the concepts that we need to do from differential equations for that specific application, and it's no longer listed as an official prerequisite or co-requisite for the course. So if you have not had differential equations, you should still be okay. Teresa, did you have a question? Okay.
I just am glad that you're saying you'll help bring us along, because yes, I've had differential equations, but it's not something I teach, so again,
sure.
It's been a while.
I understand, and that time factor is a real deal. I find that if I look over my notes from classes I took in graduate school, I'm flabbergasted. I look at and I say, I really knew that stuff? And these are my own handwritten notes. So time is a big, I know what you're talking about. But it'll come back, and I'll bring you along on the specific concepts that we need. It does say that homework will be assigned regularly, but I've already made my pitch about that, that it's not excessive. I do think there's value in presenting them well and being neat about it. It's not a class in calligraphy, but still, I think there's a physics pedagogical advantage to trying to present your work clearly. Now, my handwriting isn't the best in the world, but I think I can still write neatly enough and organize the paper neatly enough that it communicates what I'm trying to say, what I've done, what the work is, and where the answer is. So I would like to encourage that skill in you. Write your homework in a logical, clear fashion. Don't be afraid to use paper. There's no need to squish 73 problems on one page. No, the homework assignments don't have 73 problems, but you know what I'm trying to say. Deb, did you have a question?
That brings up a question for us distant ed. How do you want us to submit those assignments?
How do you want to? Because I don't care. Fax would work if that's what you're used to and done in other classes. I have the same fax number that Renee Fotz does. If you want to do it somehow electronically and email them, I don't know how you do that. If there's a good tech typesetting program package that you'd like to use, but whatever.
No, fax is fine.
Fax is fine with me too. The number is 435-283-7522. Is that okay with you, Teresa?
Actually, that'll work very well.
Okay. Well, there's other stuff in that paragraph, but you can read it. Participation, I've made a little speech about that, but I'm quite serious about it. If you do not read the textbook, you will find it extremely difficult to participate in the class discussion. And if you all do that, we won't have anything to do. I won't have anything to say. So don't come unprepared. By that I mean really, really, really read the textbook and write down questions in your notes that you might have as you go through. Bring points to discuss, because you will generate whatever happens in class. It'll come from you and what you found interesting, what you'd like to know more about, what you'd like to expand on, or questions, parts you didn't understand, like more clarification on. I'd be happy to expound on stuff, but if you haven't read and I don't bring a lecture, what are we going to do? So you have to read. And you have to participate. And I may really bring that die. One more thing under the participation paragraph. It talks about subscribing to the class email list. I have various colored lists set up, one for each different class. The color for this class is green. I used the LS yellow class list for the other physics class. This is LS-green. If you have not subscribed to a class email list before or recently and need a refresher course on that, there is a link at my website, which is again listed up at the top of the page. There's a little link that says subscribing to class lists, and it will tell you how to do it, and you need to do that soon. Now, this might play kind of a similar role as a blog might, but I'm not expecting it to be quite as interactive or intensive as you would in a blog-type situation. This is a little bit more time-independent or asynchronous. And I just haven't really jumped a whole hog into blogs yet, maybe is the real reason. But anyway, this class email list gives me a chance to forward on to you interesting tidbit things that I happen to stumble across, and I do that all the time. I read lots of websites and read lots of magazines and read lots of email, and when I get cool stuff, I'll forward it, you know, that pertains to the class, I'll forward it to LS Green. Other uses of the class list are if I forget to tell you something in class, it's really important and can't wait until the next class period, remember, after tomorrow, I won't see you again until next Tuesday, so we go a long time between class periods. If there's something I really meant to tell you, I could just email it to you. So that's another use. Possibly some assignments. If I find the coolest website in the world that's really instructive, and not only do I want you to know about it, but I want you to know about it so badly that I make it into an assignment, well, I did communicate that to you also through LS Green as well. Furthermore, and maybe we don't use this as much as we should this way, but it could be a two-way deal. You could ask me questions. You could ask each other questions as well. So I don't necessarily intend it for it to be a ongoing heated debate type thing like you might see on a blog where we're really debating the issues. That might be appropriate in some classes, maybe even this one if we decided to do that. But I think we'll do most of our discussions here in class live, but there's still lots of other uses for the class list that I think are valid. So if you don't get any email from me for 4 or 5 days, don't worry about it. It's not big deal. But then other times you might get 2 or 3 a day. You never know. So sign up for LS Green and away we go. Any questions so far? Help, I have office hours. They're every day from Monday to Friday from 10:30 to 11:30, but I know many of you might have classes or be busy at those hours, and so I need to tell you that I'm also there a lot of other hours. I have a half-time administrative position, so I don't teach very many classes. I only teach the ones that Miles is taking from me. And Jacob, well, you're all taking them. The ones you're in are the only ones I teach. So that means that I'm in my office pretty much all morning every day. So if you can't come at 10:30, you can generally find me another time. For our distant students, Teresa and Deb, email might be the best way, or if you like phones, try and give me a call. That'll work too. If you're ever in town, you know, you're more than welcome to stop by and do a face-to-face. That'd be great too. Afternoons are not as open for me as mornings because on Monday afternoons I have a meeting, and then Tuesday, Thursday is class. Tuesday, Wednesday. Then on Thursday we have physics lab. But Fridays you can catch me afternoons as well. By whatever means you want to, email or phone or whatever. So do your best. I would like to offer my services and be helpful and give you the individual consultation that you would like. I know it's more difficult for the distant students, but I'll do what I can, and I'm sure you will too. Any questions now? You can read the rest. All right. This is funny for me to be sitting in front of you and trying to generate a class discussion, but that's what I want to do. Next week we'll be around a table and it will be a little more comfortable feeling or situation. Since not everyone has the book, maybe I'll wheel my chair over to the Elmo and throw up a few things out of the book onto the Elmo and we can talk about them there. What we want to do first today, and we can't just blow off the whole day as the first day, or you don't do anything the first day of class. We can't afford to do that because we only meet twice a week, and so that would be half a week's worth if we just went home now. So we're going to actually jump in and do some physics right now. And what we want to do is kind of review the state of affairs 100 years ago when they wrote this book, or 1895 is kind of a year we want to think about. What did we know, and what didn't we know? So I'm going to go over here to the Elmo now. And we'll zoom in. Am I zooming the wrong way? Yes, I am. Okay. For those of you that have the book, this is page 3 of the textbook. If you don't have the book, then you can see it on the screen. What did we know? Now, I'd love to lecture. I really do enjoy it. I love physics so much that I could talk about it for hours and hours and hours. But I'm thoroughly convinced that you don't learn as well by listening passively as you do by active participation. So, yeah, there's kind of a starter idea here on the board. But what else could you bring up as far as what was the state of affairs in physics in, say, 1895? What did we know at that time? Let me start you off even before these. Let's go clear back to Newton. We knew Newton's laws, okay? We knew the law of inertia. We knew F equals ma, although Newton didn't say it that way. Remember how Newton really said his second law? F equals P dot, okay, dP dt, and the law of action and reaction for every force, there's an equal and opposite, well, you know those. We also knew Newton's law of gravity, okay? That was in the 1600s. That was in the 1600s. What did we learn in the 1700s and 1800s? What else did we know besides Newton's laws? It'd be time to roll my die about now.
We learned the properties of waves.
Okay, great.
Most of them.
Jacob, this is fresh on Jacob's mind because we're studying waves in physics for scientists and engineers right now. And that's exactly right. We learned that waves aren't like particles. They diffract, interfere, they're spread out, they can go through each other, and stuff like that. Starting with Thomas Young's two-slit experiment in 1801. So we knew quite a bit about waves. That's very good. And keep that thought, because that's going to play a big role in what we do in the modern physics, too, in the 20th century. By the way, just a word on the terminology. I know we're living now in the 21st century, but for the last 50 years, everybody got very used to saying or equating in their mind 20th century with modern physics. So now I know we're in the 21st century, but we're talking about 20th century physics until the end of this course when we get to interesting things like cosmology and strings, which we'll encounter some things that we didn't know until the 21st century. But for the most part, this course is concerned with 20th century physics, which until a few years ago we could say was this century. We can't say that anymore, but modern physics is 20th century physics and vice versa. Everything before that we call classical physics, okay? In fact, that's, flip back up to the Elmo, there's the section title there, classical physics, Newton's laws, and even another big set of laws that I hope you come up with here in a minute are also part of classical physics. Now, there is one, to me that makes a fairly neat package as far as in your brain, 20th century means modern, and the topics covered would be what? Well, what did we learn in the 20th century? We're getting to them, but relativity and quantum mechanics. However, a little discrepancy is occasionally people will use the word classical to refer even to relativity. Sometimes relativity is referred to as modern physics. Sometimes relativity is referred to as being a classical theory in the sense of non-quantum. So there's a little bit of two different usages in relation to relativity. Is it modern or is it classical? It's kind of classified both ways on occasion. All right, so now the ball's in your court. Jacob's done his good duty. Someone else, what else did we know in the 1890s? Teresa, you're on the screen right now, so why don't you tell us?
I'd have to start looking at dates here. I don't know. You had Maxwell before the 1900s, anyway.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I was hoping somebody would come up with that. That's the other pillar of classical physics. We have Newton's laws of mechanics, and the other main thing is Maxwell's equations of electricity and magnetism, which also govern what Jacob brought up. I mean, not all waves, but specifically electromagnetic waves, are completely described by Maxwell's equations of electricity and magnetism. So that's something we knew. And in fact, those are also in the book on page 5. And there they are in their glory. There's really four of them plus this last Lorentz force law. But the first four together as a package are Maxwell's equations of electricity and magnetism. That's classical physics. It's not relativity, it's not quantum mechanics. It's before the 1890s, and we knew that stuff really pretty well. And after this semester, you will too. This is where we're headed for this semester, okay? Good stuff. In fact, I dare say, beautiful stuff. Anything else? Miles, anything else we knew before 1890?
Probably.
Any other subfields of physics? Any other kind of main categories other than mechanics and electricity and magnetism?
I can't think of any. I'm sure there are.
Marty Lynn? The engineers have to take a course here.
Jacob? Thermodynamics?
Thermodynamics is a whole other subfield of physics. The engineers think it's theirs, but it's really physicists. We own it. We let the engineers play with thermodynamics, but it's really physics. So what did we know about thermodynamics? Well, classical thermodynamics, we would know the important laws of thermodynamics. There's the first law right there. First law of thermodynamics. There's the zeroth law and the second law and all that stuff too. And that was before 1890 also. That was fairly well understood. Now, what you might have in your brain is probably different from what they had in their brains. They understood this equation, and they understood the second law, they understood entropy, they understood all this stuff to some degree, but a lot of them were not necessarily thinking about an atomic model of matter at the time. It wasn't really until 1905 before that matter was clearly settled. Now, most people believed in atoms by 1895, but it wasn't a foregone conclusion. For example, where is this? I read this today, but I can't remember exactly where. Atomic theory, here we go. Page 15, let's look at that for a second. Although it may appear, according to the preceding discussion, that the atomic theory of matter was universally accepted by the end of the 19th century, that was not the case. Certainly most physicists believed in it, but there was still opposition. One of those was a guy by the name of Ernst Mach, who was a real philosopher and physicist, and his philosophy was called a positivist philosophy. That was a school of philosophy that's very popular in that time frame, which basically says you don't know anything until you actually see it or build it up from concrete observations. You don't start at the top with this beautiful physical theory and then deduce down to the consequences. To a positivist, you go out and make all the observations, that piece of data, that piece of data, that piece of data. You put them together, and whatever the data specifically says, you can believe. If you see it, then it's real. If you don't see it, you might think it's real, and it might be real, but you aren't sure. You can't really be sure until you've seen it and taken the data. That's the positivist school of philosophy, and Mach was one of those. And he says, you can't see atoms, so how can you be sure that they exist? So there's some non-consensus on the theory of the atomic theory of matter. But certainly most people believed in it. Anyway, the way we got off on that was Jacob brought up thermodynamics. You might be thinking atomic theory in terms of thermodynamics, molecules moving around, bumping, crashing into each other. And I would like you to think that way, but they may not have necessarily been if they didn't believe in atoms. Well, let me ask you another question. Have we made any progress on this front? Or is Ernst Mach right? Should we not believe in atoms because we haven't seen them? What's the resolution to this dilemma? Deb, I think it's your turn.
How did I know? it's the evidence. We see the electron microscope. We see the images that come up. So to say that we haven't seen it, per se, is not entirely accurate, I don't think, because we've seen the evidence for it. And the theory certainly fits what we see on these electron microscopes and things.
Okay, I buy that. I agree. That's a good comment. My response, however, if I were to play devil's advocate, would be that we didn't have electron microscopes in 1905 or even in 1920. What convinced people that there were atoms then? Now, she's right. You could go to Ernst Mach and say, you know, back in 1895, Ernst, buddy, you couldn't see atoms, but we can see atoms. We've got pictures of individual atoms, and that's a fairly striking claim to make. Why is that such an interesting claim to make? Why would Mach even maybe not believe you at first until you showed him the pictures? Why would it be rather remarkable to have a picture of an atom? Why is that astounding? Marie-Lynn? That's all true, but be more specific. How teeny are they? How big's an atom? One of my favorite calculations to do in Physics 1010 is one we're going to do. I guess we can use this one right here. Let's look at the Elmo. There's a guy by the name of Ben Franklin, who is our first great American physicist. If he were not known for being Postmaster of Philadelphia, if he were not known for Poor Richard's Almanac, if he were not known for signing the Declaration of Independence, if he were not known for being our ambassador to France and getting France to join the Revolutionary War, he would still be known as the first great American physicist. He did a lot of stuff, but one of the things he liked to do was play kind of a joke on people. And he liked to hide some oil in a hidden cavity in his cane. And when the waves on the pond were kicking up a little bit, he would take his cane and hold it out like a staff, and then let the hole go and release the oil on the waves. And he'd say, "Calm." And then the waves would calm, because the oil on top of the waves would calm the waters. So he'd sneak his oil onto them, and you know, people thought he could calm the waves. What does this have to do with atoms? Well, if you take about a teaspoon of oil and put it on a pond, it will spread out to cover about a half an acre. So what? That layer of oil is about one molecule thick. That's why it stops spreading out. It doesn't cover 72 acres. It covers a half an acre. And it stops spreading out because it's reached the limit of its thin layerness, and it's to its maximum extent. The molecules have intermolecular forces that hold it together. So it's one molecule of oil thick. Can we use that data to figure out how wide a molecule is? Sure. How would you think about it? Okay, you would say, well, first you draw a picture. There's your pond, and you draw it with a certain thickness, but then you label that thickness, that's T, and it's one molecule, but what you really know is that the area of this is half an acre, and the volume of the oil, the area times the thickness, is, what did I say, a teaspoon?
So then you just readjust the length times width times height?
Yes.
Until you get the correct width or height of the molecule,
yes. That's right. So do it for a minute. We've got plenty of time. It's only 4:17. One teaspoon over half an acre. And then, see, the way I use this in my Physics 1010 class, I do this on the second day of class when we're learning how to do unit conversions. And you all know how to do those, but they don't. And so we use this as a little exercise to do unit conversions. What is it going to come out in? Well, if we want to do the SI system, we know we're going to come out in meters. Well, that's going to work because volume is in meters cubed, and area, of course, is in meters squared. You divide those, and you're left with just meters. So what you have to do is convert lots and lots of stuff. And there are many, many, many steps to this, but that's why it's so good. It gives the students a lot of practice to do these conversions as they multiply by these parentheses factors of one. You ask yourself, what do I know about teaspoons?
Anybody know anything about teaspoons? I know something about a teaspoon.
3 teaspoons with a tablespoon? That's all I know.
3 teaspoons is 1 tablespoon.
Oh, that was right.
Then what? Do you know anything about tablespoons? 2 tablespoons is 1 fluid ounce. Do you know anything about fluid ounces? 1 fluid ounce is 1.8 cubic inches. That 3 is in separate parentheses. And, of course, the 10-10 students have to stop and think about this exponent, why it's inside the parentheses, and then maybe why the next one, and I don't have room there, so I'm going to continue on down over here, why the next parenthesis has the cube outside the exponent outside the parentheses. What do we know about inches? 1 inch is 2.54 centimeters. And the last step on this part would be 100 centimeters is 1 meter. And if you see what can cancel now, you'd say, oh good, we can cancel teaspoons, cancel tablespoons, fluid ounces, cubic inches, and cubic centimeters. And we're left with cubic meters in the numerator and acres in the denominator. So we have to keep going because we don't like the acres. So what do you know about acres? Well, 1 acre is 4,840 square yards. Do I expect my physics 10-10 students to know all these things? No, I tell them. I give them a little table of these conversion factors. They're supposed to know 2.54 centimeters equals 1 inch, but pretty much the rest I... So, what do you know about square yards? I know that 1 yard is, we can skip a couple of steps and go straight to inches, okay? We don't have to go to feet. And then we've run out of room again, so we're going to come over here and do some more. These are all one big long string of multiplied factors. What do I know about inches? I know that 1 inch is 2.54 centimeters. And you discuss with them why this 2 is inside the parentheses, and you discuss with them why this 2 is outside the parentheses. It's a pretty important point. Some of them will understand it right away, and others will have to think about it. But then we make the last step here, and we say that 100 centimeters is 1 meter, and that has to be squared too. Now, I'd like you to take out your TI and do all that, or your HP, and see what you get. And you have to cube the appropriate factors, and you have to square the appropriate factors, and you also have to be convinced that when the day's over, the acres canceled, and the square yards canceled, and square inches canceled, square centimeters canceled. And we have square meters in the denominator, but we had cubic meters in the numerator, and so the final answer is going to be an answer in meters, and we're very pleased about that, but what's the number? What did you get?
I think I did it wrong when I looked at how it showed up on the calculator.
Oh.
Like it wasn't the right format.
I got 1.2 times 10 to the negative 9.
Good.
That's what I got.
Now, did you do the half here, Deb?
Okay, forgot about the half.
So it's probably really double that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, 2.4. We don't really care very many significant figures here. I mean, how accurate would that be that Benjamin Franklin's cane holds exactly a teaspoon? I mean, that's not 3 significant figures. And the covering the half an acre of water, that's not very precise either. So I hardly care about even more than 1 significant figure. But the general range here, the factor of 10 is what we care about. How big are atoms is the question. And we're really answering it indirectly by finding out how big molecules are, but oil molecules can be fairly small. Did you get this number now, Miles? Marty Lynn? You almost there? Teresa, did you get a good answer?
Well, I got 10 to the minus 9th, but not that other number.
10 to the minus 9th is 10 to the minus 9th is good enough for me. 10 to the minus 9 is also known in SI parlance as nano. So we could put 2.4 nanometers or 1.2 nanometers if we forgot to have. It doesn't matter. The point is, a few nanometers. A few, like a one or two nanometers. And this is a molecule, so an atom might be just a little bit less than that. Okay, an atom is a couple of nanometers across. Now, the question Marty was trying to answer originally, I mean, the intermediate question was, how big are atoms? But why did we want to know how big our atoms are? Because the earlier question was, why is it remarkable to tell Ernst Mach that we can see atoms? Why is that an astounding claim to make? And Marty's telling us, because atoms are how big? A couple of nanometers. And the light you use to see them with is how big? How do you see things? Light bounces off them into your eye. Turns out that for waves, a property of waves is that they're not disturbed or changed much by obstacles that are really, really tiny compared to their wavelength. Now, for daily life, this doesn't matter. You look at your hand, you look at a pen, you look at your significant other, they are much bigger than the wavelength of light. And so you see them easily. Light bounces off of their face, or off of the pages of your book, or off of your pen, into your eye, just fine. Reflection. But if you try to look at something that's smaller than the light waves, the waves just go right past it, and they don't reflect off. It's tough to see things that are smaller than light waves. Or I shouldn't just say tough. You can't do it. And it's not a matter of, well, gee, maybe we didn't grind the lens smooth enough on our microscope. Let's get a better lens. Let's improve our technology so that we can see finer detail. Now, if you have crappy lenses, that's a problem. But getting better lenses is only going to help to a certain point. It is not ever, no matter how good your lenses get, going to help you see things the size of atoms. Because atoms are how big? A couple of nanometers. How big are light waves? We talked about this in class yesterday. We found out how big they were yesterday in class.
A couple of nanometers.
In the angstrom range, according to what wavelength you're talking about.
That's true. How big is an angstrom?
I'm not sure exactly how much smaller it is from a nanometer, but it's smaller than a nanometer.
It's a tenth of a nanometer. So if light waves are only a couple of angstroms big, then we ought to be able to see atoms, because the light waves would be smaller than the atom. The atom would be one or two nanometers big, and a light wave would be one or two tenths of a nanometer big, because an angstrom is only a tenth of a nanometer. But if you look, and sometimes wavelengths are given in angstroms, so Deb is entirely correct about that, but how many angstroms is it? It's 4,000 of them. Or 7,000 of them. And by the time you look at something as big as 4,000 angstroms, by the way, that would be the same as 400 nanometers, or 700 nanometers. The range of the wavelengths of light are 400 to 700 nanometers, or in angstroms, 4,000 to 7,000 angstroms. But either way, regardless of which unit you use, that's a few hundred times bigger than an atom. So you have a wave coming along trying to see a speck. And the light wave is not inhibited or disturbed or obstacled or influenced much at all by this gigantic wave. Now, maybe the atom gets shaken by the wave and moves, but the wave isn't much affected, and the wave doesn't reflect much off this tiny little speck that's only a hundredth of the size of the wave.
Wait, when you say it's not reflected much, it wouldn't be reflected at all, would it?
It's not a
on or off deal. It's not a binary choice. You can have a little bit of reflection and most of the wave go through. That's why I've been careful with my language. I haven't said there's no reflection. It depends on the size. If you get a pretty big speck of stuff that's a few hundred atoms clumped together, then you'd get some reflection due to a light wave. It's dependent on the size, and it might not be ever totally zero reflection, but not enough to make an image and not enough to see stuff. You can't image this reflected light. The waves are simply too large in wavelength to see the object you're trying to see. This is called diffraction-limited optics. And we've run into this. My class was asking me the other day about these new DVDs. Blu-ray. You've heard of these, right? HDTV. They've got these new discs. We started off with the CDs, and then the same form factor, but now they've got finer information on regular DVDs, hold 10 times as much as a CD. But now we've got the new ones. Just this year. Well, I guess 2006 is last year. They introduced HD DVD and Blu-ray. These are the competing formats. What's new about them? Why are we able to fit on 5 gigabytes on one of these Blu-ray DVDs, whereas on the old ones we could only fit on 2 gigabytes, or whatever the numbers are, 25 gigabytes. I don't even remember how much they could fit on, but it's a couple of orders of magnitude more information on these new discs than the old ones. Why are we able to do that? And the terminology gives you a hint. They're called Blu-ray because we're using blue lasers to read the pits on the disc. And blue waves have a shorter wavelength. So shorter wavelengths can see smaller things. So you can make the pits on your disc physically smaller, and the red lasers wouldn't see them. But a blue laser with its smaller wavelength can see these smaller pits. Is this making any sense? Is everybody following this? But even blue waves, which are only...
How do they make the blue laser? What do they use to as the excitation medium?
Homework? I don't know. Good question. Find out and tell us tomorrow. I don't know what the blue lasers are made of. But even blue rays, blue light waves, are their wavelength is still 400 times the size of an atom. So even blue light is not going to see atoms, individual atoms. So now we can be impressed. If we go to Ernst Mach, who's the positivist, and he says if you can't see it, you can't be sure it's there. You don't know their atoms because you can't see them. And we come and we say, you know, since the 1980s, we have been seeing atoms. And he'd go, whoa, how can you do that? The wavelength of light, even the shortest wavelength of light, is 100 or 400 times larger than an atom. You can't see an atom with light. That's why it's so impressive to claim to see atoms. And yet that's the very claim that, who made it? You, Deb, or was it Teresa? Somebody said we could see atoms.
Because we don't use frequency in the light range.
That's exactly right. So how is it that we're seeing atoms now? Well, are there waves that are shorter than blue? Yeah, purple. But purple's hard to see. And what's shorter than purple? Ultra purple! Only we call it ultraviolet. They're shorter still, right? And in fact, in the latest computer chips, when they etch the circuit elements into a piece of silicon to make semiconductor devices, transistors that power your computer, they use ultraviolet light to make those etchings for the very same reason. They can make them smaller than they used to could. Everything's getting smaller. You can pack millions of transistors into the same amount of silicon that 30 years ago you could only put thousands of transistors into. And the reason, if one of the reasons is that we can etch these things with a finer beam that's smaller wavelength, that we use ultraviolet now. Is there anything smaller than ultraviolet? I mean, even ultraviolet's too big to see an atom. Is there any waves that are smaller than ultraviolet? Can we see atoms or not?
X-rays.
All right. X-rays are smaller than ultraviolet. This is a good thought. In fact, in the 1950s, one of the most significant experiments ever done goes down in history as one of the stellar things that everyone should know about, was the discovery of the structure of DNA by Watson and Crick, 1953. How did Watson and Crick figure out that DNA is this twisted helix, double helix, that's the name of their book, the double helix, this twisted ladder with rungs around it like a spiral staircase? How did they do that? X-ray diffraction. They shine X-rays at this.
Okay, but I have to argue it wasn't it wasn't Watson and Crick. Oh. Rosalind, now I forgot her name, but Rosalind, she should have gotten a Nobel Prize for that, because she's the one that produced the actual photograph that Watson took the information.
I stand corrected, you're absolutely right. But she didn't get the Nobel Prize. Whether she should have or not, I agree. She probably should have been included. She's one of those neglected historical figures in science that didn't get the credit she deserved. Watson and Crick got all the credit, but she did a lot of the significant work, but they then did the analysis and kind of occurred to them what the data meant. And again, the point is that they shine X-rays, it diffracts through these slits and around these atoms, and they get the diffraction pattern like we saw in class today, and they figure out the structure from that. So X-rays are the right size. You know what, though? There's a problem with X-rays, and that's they're very energetic, and they blow stuff apart. And it's tough to look at living things with X-rays because it kills them. And even X-rays, it's tough to get down, clear down to the size of an individual atom. So, as whoever it was, I think it was Teresa, said a long time ago, what we really use are something that has a wavelength that's smaller than X-rays but doesn't blow it apart. Electrons. Electron microscopes. Maybe that was you that said that, Deb. But electron microscopes. We can make electron waves that are small enough to see atoms. Now, Mach might come back with a counter-argument and say, very clever. Very, very clever. And very impressive. It's amazing technology. But do you really call that seeing? This is not light, it didn't go into your eye, it's electrons, and it's data in a computer. You could argue with Mach till the cows come home as to whether that really qualifies as seeing or not, but nonetheless, we can produce photographs from the data, we can construct diagrams, and show molecular structure and see individual atoms. There are lots of pictures like this on the web, and so while it's not traditional seeing with light and an eye, it is still detecting features and shapes and surfaces of molecules and atoms, and we can do that. Okay, boy, that was a kind of a long, tangent off to the side, but it was kind of fun. The question we were addressing was how do we convince people of the atomic theory before electron microscopes? How did Einstein do it in 1905? He pretty much tipped people over the edge. Whatever people were remaining unbelievers were basically convinced by Einstein's paper in 1905. Not the one he won the Nobel Prize for, not the one that did special relativity, but the other one. He convinced everybody that matter is made of atoms. Those few remaining people that weren't absolutely convinced, like Mach. One of my favorite desserts is brownies. Does that help?
He wrote a paper on brownie in motion?
Yes! They're not named after brownies, but named after a guy named Brown. What's brownie in motion? Teresa, tell us a little bit about it.
Well, if I remember, a long time, even before Einstein, didn't they? That you'd suspend smoke particles and water or whatever, and if you look at them through a microscope, they jiggle, they move, they're drifting around.
That's exactly right, and they did notice, Brown, noticed it quite a few years before Einstein wrote his paper, But Einstein wrote the paper that explained that it's atoms kicking into these little particles that convinced everyone that stuff is made of atoms. So prior to Einstein, they'd seen the effect Brown had, that's why it's called, named after him, precisely as Teresa mentioned, particles that you can see, little grains of pollen, which are actually quite small, but you suspend them in a fluid and look at them in a microscope, you can see them jiggle and jostle around in sort of a random motion. You can see that because it's actually big enough for light waves to reflect off of, interact with, and come back into your eye. You can see this through a microscope. But what makes them jiggle? And it's just kind of this interface between the visible and the non-visible. The things that are jiggling the visible pollen grains are smaller than that, and just small enough that you can't see them, but they're atoms crashing into these pollen grains, little molecules in the fluid that smack into it and push it that way, and another crash and another crash, and so it moves around in this random motion. And Einstein came up with that explanation that it's atoms that are doing that, and everyone said, yeah, that's got to be right, that's why it's jiggling around, so matter really is made of atoms. And that pretty much convinced everybody. And then later in the 80s, we refined our microscopes so well that we can, so to speak, see them. All right, that was a long thing. But let's bring this, kind of wrap it up somewhat. Let's look back at the ELMO. I want to look at page 13 for a minute. Here, the diagram at the bottom. And see if this kind of makes some sense as far as a summary sort of thing of what we knew. There's some names on there. The stuff at the bottom, let's get a sharper thing than the big pen, let's use a pencil. These things are fundamental forces of nature, and a major goal of physics today is to unify these. In fact, there are actually four fundamental forces of nature. There's the weak force, the electromagnetic force, the strong force, and the gravitational force. And already, these three guys won the Nobel Prize for explicating the mathematical theory that shows how these are really manifestations of one single force, now called the electroweak force. That is to say, under certain conditions, these two forces become indistinguishable. They're the same force. They are not the conditions that we live in. In our world, it's too cold, and we see these as different forces. Weak does totally different things than electromagnetism. But it's high enough temperatures that we can achieve in atom smashers and the Big Bang. We think we have a good mathematical theory and an explanation of how these were unified at those conditions. If we could get to those types of temperatures, then they would be indistinguishable. So that's why there are only three boxes here. The goal now is to continue doing that. At some much higher temperature, can you unify the strong force in with this and get a grand unified theory? That's the t-shirt you see physics majors wear that says, physicists have guts. GUT stands for grand unified theory. And then, of course, you'd like to, even combining gravitation, have a theory of everything, a toe. Theory of everything. That would be this single force here. That's going to be the toughest one. We think we're fairly close to doing this, but this is a ways away. And there's some attempts to do this, and we'll talk about them at the end of the course. But we knew all about electrical stuff. We knew all about magnetic stuff in the 1800s. We understood in Maxwell that it also explained light waves, electromagnetic waves. And then, of course, over here, astronomical motion and terrestrial motion. Newton tied those together with his law of gravitation. He said, very significantly so, that the same force that makes the moon go around the earth causes apples to fall out of trees. This was a significant step forward in our understanding of the unity of nature, that the same laws apply everywhere. And so Newton's mechanics, and then Einstein comes in and throws in his relativity. So this is kind of a diagram of all of that stuff. Any questions or comments so far? I'm talking a lot more today than I plan to in the future, but that's because you might not have read yet, and you might not have your book yet. But by next time,
you will be doing the talking, and I will be nodding my head and answering questions. But let's end up today with the clouds on the horizon. Outstanding problems is how Thornton and Rex refer to it. It seems like we had a pretty good picture. The diagram I just showed you was pretty nice. We knew a whole bunch of stuff. We knew mechanics. We knew electricity and magnetism. We knew thermodynamics. All these were classical theories that were fairly well understood. And furthermore, they were very successful in practical applications, in making your life better, in engineering, in building devices, in inventing things. These classical theories worked extremely well. You can build all the bridges across all the rivers in the world. You can build all the cars you want to. You can build buildings. You can even get to the moon, pretty much, without needing anything more than those classical theories. You can make radios and televisions. All this stuff can be built on classical physics. Very, very successful. In fact, we get to the point in about 1898 when, who was it? I'm trying to find the citation on the web and I couldn't come up with it very quickly today. But some famous physicist gets up at some physics meeting, and I'm paraphrasing here, so I need to go find the exact quote, but basically says, physics is about over. We've got it all figured out. We do need to work out a few more decimal places on some of these physical constants. We'd like to know the speed of light to another decimal of precision. We'd like to know the charge on an electron to another decimal of precision. We have a little bit more tidying up to do. But basically, there's nothing new to be discovered. Basically, we understand the theories of nature. And in a few years, we'll be able to present physics as a present to humanity, wrapped up, tied with a bow, and say, here it is, and then we'll be able to go away and get real jobs. How mistaken could someone be? That was on the eve of all of this stuff that we're going to learn in this course. That's when they understood all the classical stuff that we learned in physics for scientists and engineers, which is very successful and is pretty much all you need if you're going to be a civil engineer or a mechanical engineer. But if you're going to be an electrical engineer or a computer engineer or a chemical engineer or a physicist, you can't do your work with classical physics. That was on the eve of 1900. And in 1900, and then especially in 1905, significant things took place. There were a few niggling little clouds on the horizon, I call them. Just, you know, it wasn't a totally blue sky. There were these few little clouds in 1898 that they knew about. There were a few little problems, but they figured they could solve them all. They figured they could figure it out, do the experiments, understand the concepts and theories, and finish physics. It turns out that those little clouds on the horizon moved in and dumped a whole lot of showers on us. It turned out to be significant. What were those little clouds on the horizon? What were the outstanding problems of 1895? And we'll leave with these today. Go ahead, who's going to talk?
Well, I was just going to say, didn't Einstein go to his grave still believing that ether was the medium for electromagnetic energy?
No, Einstein didn't. You're confusing two stories, I believe, and they're both
okay.
They're both true, but they don't want to confuse them. Einstein went to his grave not being comfortable with quantum mechanics. He never quite reconciled to that. But the guy who did the other experiment that demonstrated that there's no ether never believed the results of his own experiment, and that was Michelson. Michelson went to his grave not believing in his own results, that he had disproven the electromagnetic medium. Now, for the rest of you who don't quite know what she's referring to, one of the clouds on the horizon, on this page 15, what is it, 16, is the one at the bottom of the page, the electromagnetic medium. Prior to 1887, what should I say? Everything we knew about waves up until this time showed or required we understood that every wave needed some kind of medium. I've emphasized this over and over in our other physics class, that waves are not stuff moving from point A to point B. Waves are a disturbance of a medium. That's the disturbance is what's moving from point A to point B. I've emphasized this over and over. String waves, sound waves, all kinds of waves, longitudinal, transverse, spring waves, it doesn't matter. You've got to have a medium there that gets displaced and then exerts forces on the next chunk of medium, the next harmonic oscillator, and it displaces the next one after that. The leaves on the pond, when you drop the rock in and the waves spread out on the surface of the pond, these expanding ripples, the leaves don't move. They go up and down transverse as the wave passes through them, but it's the disturbance that causes them to go up and down. Then the disturbance moves on out. The disturbance propagates. But the water doesn't, and the leaves on top of the water showing where the water is, they don't move out. The stuff doesn't move in a wave. The disturbance is what moves. So you've got to have something to disturb. Every wave needs a medium. I've tried to emphasize this pretty strongly. And so light, being a wave, clearly needs a medium. Something that it can disturb as it travels through. That it's the disturbance that travels. That's what the wave is. So what is it for light? Is it the air molecules like it is for sound? Of course, sound doesn't have to be in air. You can have sound in other stuff too. You can have sound in water, and so it doesn't have to be air. But notice that each one of these things is a material medium. Tabletops, water, or air all propagate sound, but they're all mediums that allow that jiggling disturbance to propagate through. Is that what the medium is for light? Well, no, because light goes through empty space. Light gets here from the sun, and the sun's 93 million miles of nothing away from us. Not air. It's not string, it's not springs, all these other kinds of waves we experimented with. Those are not the medium for light. So what did physicists conclude? There had to be this other stuff that pervades all space, even empty space. Even vacuum is full of this ether. They called it the luminiferous ether. And the real only reason they needed to have it was because light needed a medium to travel through. That's the only reason they invented it, because it's got weird properties otherwise. It's totally non-viscous. The Earth goes around it through this ether around the sun in its orbit every year with no problem, no slowing, no friction, no resistive medium, no damping. So it's totally non-viscous. You can't see it, you can't smell it, you can't taste it, it has no mass. It's got weird properties, but it has to be there so that the light can travel through it. Well, in 1887, they did the experiment that Deb referred to. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, Deb?
No, I don't know the details about it, but it'll be interesting to know.
Well, it's on this DVD we're going to watch one of these days. It's this one right here. It's very famous. It's probably the most famous negative experiment ever in physics, where the answer came back totally what we didn't expect. Everybody knew that this experiment was going to prove the existence of this ether. It had to be there. It was finally time to demonstrate it and show that it was really there. And the experiment showed that it really wasn't there. And it was so startling that the very experimenter never believed it. All right, that's one of them. Another couple of these things, we'll hit these in a little more detail maybe next time. Electrodynamics, we'll talk about an interesting thing there and what Einstein did with that. Black body radiation is one I'd like to spend some more time on next time. Read up on this. Here's an important diagram. Spend some time looking at this before next time. Try to understand that, and we'll discuss it some more. It's really quite an important concept. but it's also one that we couldn't explain classically, and we had to come up with a new kind of physics to explain it. And the fact that the ultraviolet catastrophe is the other one here. We will leave that here, and we will close class today with little clouds on the horizon, and they're going to move in and rain on us, and they're going to cause us to overthrow classical physics and replace it with modern physics. Classical physics still works as well as it ever did. Newton's laws of gravitation and mechanics work as well as they ever did. It's just that they never did work well in certain conditions. We just didn't know about them originally, but in certain extreme conditions, they're wrong, and they always have been wrong. We just didn't know it until we got better ones. You can still build buildings and bridges and go to the moon with Newton's laws. But you can't do some other things with Newton's laws that we will talk about in this course. Any concluding thoughts or comments from any of you? Like I say, the homework for the first couple of chapters is already up on the website. There's no reason why you can't get started if you'd like to. I'll try to get more of a schedule and kind of tell you when due dates are coming. I haven't been real strict about due dates. And last year when we taught this class, I was too lax, and they didn't turn them in until the end of the course, and that didn't work. So I'll try and give you some due dates, but I won't be really rigid about it. I want to be more laid back than in the other class. Anyway, this is going to be fun. I'm looking forward to it. Tomorrow we'll be in this room, but next week we'll try to move across the hall. Get your books as soon as you can, or come borrow one of mine, and it's time to quit. So we'll see you all tomorrow. Email me if you have questions. Call me. Look on the website. Whatever you need to do. Let's see if we've got a podcast here.